If you could help me welcome our speaker for tonight, Steve W. from York, Pennsylvania.
My name is Steve. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
My sobriety date is January 23rd of 09. I like to say it's been a little over 3.5 years since I wanted to kill myself. If that makes sense to anybody in here, it makes perfect sense to me. I need a drink with a friend. All right, excuse me. my home group is the Way Out Group in York, Pennsylvania. It meets on Thursdays and Saturdays at 8 p.m. if you're ever in York. if you used to be from York, you used to be called Rainbow. We changed the name, Lonzo. I didn't know if you knew that. So my job is pretty simple up here. It's just to tell you what things were like, what happened, and what things are like today. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love the 12 steps because they changed my life 100%, man. I can't speak enough about... I wish I would have found these steps a little earlier. I wish everybody in the world could follow these steps. And you know, I work with guys that are not... they're not alcoholic, but they're sick people, man. And it took one of the hardest things for me to do was realize that there are a lot of sick people out there, and you don't have to be alcoholic to be a sick person. And I deal with these people, and you know, and a lot of them like I used to be, like a liar, cheat, and steal, and all these things that I know if I start doing again, my life's going to get real messed up, and I'm going to end up right back where I started. And I don't ever want to feel the way I felt before. And if that's why I'm here. Because I came to AA because guys were coming into the rehab that I was in, and when they come in right away, I'm thinking there's no way this guy knows how I feel. There is not a chance in the world he knows, and then they come to tell me about how they were and how they felt and how they couldn't sleep at night and how they treated people and how they had no one left in their life because of the way they ran through people's lives and terrorized people in like a tornado, and that was me, like, absolutely. I burned a lot of bridges, and through AA and 12 steps, like, I'm rebuilding all of them bridges I burnt. I don't think there's probably only a small handful of people that still won't talk to me, you know what I mean, which is pretty good, you know what I mean, really, because I there's a lot of people that didn't want to ever see my face again, and for instance, my parents, like, they call me every day, and, like, sometimes, like, it's kind of mean, like, I'm just, like, sometimes they call, and I'm like, I look at my phone and I'm like, oh God, like I'm busy right now, but like, and that's just me being selfish, you know what I mean? Because they just want to know how I am, you know. I'm originally from New Jersey, and I grew up with a mom, a dad, and two brothers. I was the middle child. Not that that means anything, but both my brothers are outgoing good people, and I'm not. Like, I remember when I was a kid, they would have friends and I would tag along, especially my older brother, and I would tag along and I would become friends with these people. And like, my best friends are always really outgoing people because like, I need someone to do all the talking. You know what I mean? I need somebody to step up and do all the stuff, and I'll just follow you and I'll just listen. And you know what I mean? I used to say, like, I'm a good ear. You know what I mean? I can just sit there and you can talk all day, and that works for me. Cause I don't gotta say nothing and worry about if I'm saying something stupid or worry about, you know, just anything. Cause I'm a worrier. You know what I mean? I'm a miserable person and I worry about every single thing that happens. Like, and I stay up at night late thinking about, well, what tomorrow this person's gonna say this, and if they say this to me in school, I'm gonna say this back, and then back and forth, and it's just like nonsense, and it goes on and on and on. But I grew up around. Like I said, I grew up in North Jersey, in Jersey City, and my uncles lived around me, and all the time growing up, they were drinking. Everybody had beers. I remember a smoky kitchen with beers, cracking beers. My uncle would send us to go get beers all day. They'd have a cooler no matter what time of year it was, winter, didn't matter. The fridge didn't hold enough, you know what I mean? So they had a cooler out. And I still remember my uncle, like, every time my uncle would crack a beer, he would blow the... like all the fuzz on top, he blew it in my face, and he thought it was hilarious. And I actually got a chance to do that to him, like in sobriety. I went to my older brother's wedding, and he asked me to get him a beer. He's like, "Go get me a beer, boy." And I went and got it, and as soon as I cracked it, I blew it right in his face. And I said, remember that? It felt good, you know what I mean? Because, hey, man, it comes around. What goes around comes around, man. He didn't think it was too funny, but he's a bit older now, and he can't really... Before he'd get up and chase me down, he can't do that no more. I can outrun him, I know that. One of my other uncles, his brother died on a bar stool. You know what I mean? His wife died from cancer when she was 35, and he figured that the best thing to do... Like, he's never called himself an alcoholic, so I can't very well do that. But he thought the solution to his problem of his wife dying so early was to move above a bar. If you drink all the time and you move above a bar, I mean, it's, you don't got to go nowhere. You just stay there. And he had a massive heart attack, like, sitting at the bar at, like, 11 in the morning. And died before he hit the floor. And that's just how it goes. I like to tell people, like, the way alcoholics die isn't, like, a nice, sweet, you know, fall asleep, like, die in your bed. We die, like, face down, like, by ourselves, and like, choking on our own throw-up. Like, that's the kind of way we die, like, when we're out there. I don't want to die alone. I don't want to be someone that no one calls or tries to find me because no one wants to know where I'm at or no one cares. Like, that's not how I want to die. So I grew up around a bunch of alcohol. It seemed normal to me. It was no big deal. Everyone was just drink. My uncle and my aunt pretty much raised us because my mom had two jobs, my dad had two jobs, and my aunt and uncle lived upstairs, and my uncle was on disability, and they lived right upstairs from us, so they pretty much raised us, and I never lived in one place for a long time. Like I said, this has nothing to do with me being an alcoholic, but it just has something to do with, like, me not being able to fit in. Like, I don't have any friends that I've had my entire life. Like, I just don't. Like, I don't understand when people say that. Or, like, I moved out of New Jersey when I was, like, 10, and we moved to Maryland. I remember Dad coming saying, like, hey, we were, like, outside playing handball or something. He came out and said, hey, you guys want to move to Maryland? I said, no. He said, well, 2 weeks, you know. 2 weeks later, we're in a car moving to Maryland. And that became something that happened a lot. So now here I am, 10 years old, right when I should be, like, having fun with people and, you know, learning new things and like, hanging out with my friends. I moved to a new place where I already have problems meeting new people as it is because I'm not a big talker at all. We moved to Maryland, and we stayed there for probably 6 months and then moved again in Maryland. Ended up in Edgewood, Maryland. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of it, but... And that's where things really took off. I mean, one of the guys that's actually, I'm getting married in August, and he's one of my best men. He actually came to the door. He's a real outgoing guy. Seen that a couple new kids moved into the neighborhood and came and knocked on the door and see if he wanted to come out and play or whatever. Him having not done that, you know, I don't know how long I would have gone without having friends because this is how I am. Like, moving on a little bit, the type of person I am from the start, like, I'm one of the people that believe, like, I had alcoholic, tendencies or whatever since I was born. Like, a lot of people don't believe that. That's just, that's what I believe. Like, lying and cheating and stealing as young as I can remember. I heard my first drink when I was, like, 12. Like a lot of people in the woods drinking, you know what I mean? Someone steals liquor from their parents, you go in the woods, you drink it, whatever. I just remember passing this bottle around and feeling part of. And the noise in my head, like me talking to myself, worrying about, okay, well, if this guy's, I don't want to look stupid, so if this guy does this and this does, I'm going to do this and do that. Like, I'm trying to, like, play in my mind all these things that I'm going to do. And as soon as I started taking a couple drinks out of this bottle, which was disgusting, by the way, I think it was gin or something. Oh, my God. I started not caring about none of that stuff. You know, I started talking normal. I felt like a weight lifted off my shoulders. I felt like, you know, it talks about in the book, like, I had arrived type thing. Like, and that's what I felt like. I felt like I didn't care about anything else. You know, I just didn't care. Like, I'm climbing trees and running around, and, like, I'm all happy. Like, this is amazing. Like, this was, like, the best thing that's ever happened to me. And this was my first experience with it. Like, I remember, like, toward the end of the day, I remember, like, holding on and laying on the ground, holding on to grass, like, felt like I was going to fall to earth. Like, oh, my God, it was horrible. But the next day I woke up and was like, whatever, you know, now I know why my parents and my uncles and everybody, I know why they drink all the time. I understand now. Like, it makes sense to me. And I'm, like, 12 years old, and this is, I felt like everything's clicking finally. Like, my life starts to make sense right now. Probably 12 or 13 years old. I don't know. I think you're in like sixth grade. And I had two brothers that my mom, we had $1.40 for lunch. And she was working two jobs as a waitress and somewhere else, Best Buy or something. And she's filling these envelopes with enough money for all three of us for a week's worth of lunch at school. And I'm rooting through a room trying to find money. First of all, I find a whole stack of them centennial dollar bills or something. They're really old. They have the weird print on them. I forget what they're called. Yeah, I heard something like that. Yeah, I stole all them right away. And I stole all them little manila envelope packets of this money. I'm like 13 years old. I'm trying to go get, you know, because back then it was like you can get a case of the Beast for like $7.29 or something like that. And there was a guy in my neighborhood who was one of my friend's older brothers, and he would, by all means, yeah, sure, buy me a 40, I'll get you whatever you want. I don't care. I'll get you something every day if you want. And that's what we did. That's what I continued to do. And I felt no remorse about taking that money because I felt like I needed it. Like, and that was a reoccurring thing. Like, me justifying and rationalizing everything that I'm thinking and everything that I'm doing makes sense to me because well, she has a job, so she'll make more money, but I need this because I need to feel all right with myself. And, like, people shouldn't feel like that when they're, like, that young. You know what I mean? Middle school, when I'm feeling like this, like, I need to shut my head up. I need to be all right, and I'm not all right. I knew that from the start. I always felt like I was different than everybody. So that continued. Like, I was one of them guys that constantly got in trouble, drinking every single day if I could. Like, from the start, I wasn't a weekend warrior. I was like, every day, if I can get it, I'm getting it, and that's it. Like, that was my primary purpose when I woke up. I didn't go to school very much. Just so happened that the assistant principal that was in charge of attendance happened to become good friends with my mom because of them talking so much, and they're going out to lunch and everything else. It was horrible for me. But, like, I did graduate high school on, like, the 5-year plan, but I don't know how. I was thinking about it actually earlier today. I don't think I've ever done homework in my entire life, not even once. I don't know how I got through school, but all through high school, man, like, that's all we did. I would skip school, like, every day just because I knew my friends had a liquor cabinet that was, like, they had a lock on it, but we knew where the key was because we had found that right away. Like, you know, like, just like alcoholics, man, if we find out what your PIN number is for your bank card, believe me, I still remember a bunch of people's bank numbers. You know what I mean? Their 4-digit PIN. That's something that'll stick with me forever because that was important to me. Like, if I can get to your money, like, that's how I'm going to get to it. And I can't remember anything. Like, I'm really burnt, but I can remember those PIN numbers from years ago. Like, I don't know what it is. I don't know why, but so high school was, I didn't go really. I just stayed out there and drank. After graduating, I moved down to Baltimore because it seemed like a good idea. It really wasn't a good idea when I look back on it, but it seemed like one at the time. Started getting it, you know, I'm an absolute alcoholic from the start. I absolutely have no doubt in my mind about this. But I'm also, like, I need more of whatever I can get my hands on just to get me out of myself. On whatever it is, I don't care what it is. If you give it to me, like, I'm glad, like, people were talking about, like, bath salts and all this crazy stuff. Like, I was talking to my fiance, and I was like, I'm so glad that came out after I got sober. You know what I mean? Because people doing all this crazy stuff on it and be like, I mean, I got to try that. You know what I mean? Just because, whatever, I don't care what it is. So, right when I got out of high school was about when things like started to, I started to see my life going like in absolutely no direction. I did go to school, a tech school, while I was working, but the whole time I'm working, I'm stealing from my job, I'm cheating on hours, I'm doing all these things, I'm like 20 years old. When I was 16, I got arrested for stealing cars and all these things that a 16-year-old should not be doing. I remember going, my mom thought I should go to a psychiatrist because of it. She was like, why are you doing this stuff? And I was like, I don't know. Like, I don't know if it was just to get out, just for me to get out of myself, just so I don't have to, I don't know what it was. I was skipping school, but I would sneak out every night and like break into people's things and steal people's cars and all this stuff that would just take me out of myself for that night. Like if I couldn't get no alcohol in me, I would do whatever it takes just to get me out of myself. And luckily, I was a juvenile because that didn't carry over. But she had me go to a psychiatrist, and I remember not being honest with the psychiatrist not one single day. And I think back on it now, I was like, I probably kind of need to make amends for that to my mom because I don't know how much money she spent on that. But I probably seen that dude like, I don't know, for like 6 months straight once a week. And I don't know how much that cost, and I know they didn't have a lot of money, but I was not honest with that guy. The only thing that guy knew about me that was true was my name, you know. And it was, you know, and I seen, and it, I don't know, just looking back, it was like such a waste of money, man. I feel bad about it. But moving on, like I just want to, a couple things about, because I'm going to get sober real quick here. A couple things, like I said, I'm an alcoholic from the start, absolutely, and this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I absolutely want to, you know, I'm big on the book, and I'm about the traditions and all that, and but there's just some things about me, like the way, the kind of person that I'm capable of being, and I know Eric's heard me a bunch, and I'd like to thank him also for coming up with me again. He's always coming with me everywhere, man, it's awesome. But, like, I have a grandmother that, that was a very important person in my life. She's always been there ever since I was a kid. She was a short little Irish lady from she moved over here when she was 20 from Ireland. She had a thick brogue, and she was always a part of my life. She was the strongest woman I've ever met in my life. And while I'm down in Baltimore drinking every night, like people go to the bar to socialize, like, and I thought that was stupid. I go to the bar when there's dollar bottles. That's when I go. Other than that, I'm staying home. You know what I mean? I don't go to the bar to socialize. I don't socialize with anybody, period. Like, but I'm down there doing my thing. And my mom, she got real sick with cancer and a bunch of other stuff. I was too selfish and self-centered to even ask or to even comprehend what was wrong with her. I just knew she was sick. I didn't even ask. So she's on hospice, and this was like 2005, I think. She's on hospice at my mom's house. And my mom calls me one night, and she's like, you need to probably come up here and say goodbye to your grandma because she's probably not going to last very long. And I said, all right. I don't think I made it up there that day. I think it was like a day or two afterwards because I got things that I have to do. So I take the ride up there. I take the ride up there, and I sit down with her next to her bed. And she can't talk at all or nothing. She can just move her eyes. You know what I mean? I can see her looking at me dead in my eyes, but she can't say anything. Bless you. And as I'm talking to her, I'm just saying, you know, just I don't even remember what I was saying. You know, just goodbye, this or that. And as I'm talking to her, right in the middle of the conversation, I like just glance around behind me and on the dresser and like I said, I know Turner heard me say this before. This is the best way I can describe it. You know, like in movies when light shines through a window and it hits something and it's glowing and it looks like this big and it's like just amazing. Well, I glance back and I look back and I see this like light shine and everything, and it's this big giant glass jar of liquid, and it says concentrated liquid morphine on it. Like, and I swear it seemed like it was like 10 feet tall, man. I'd like to say that right then and there, that conversation with my grandma ended right away. And I'm being sneaky, trying to get some of this stuff just because, like, I've never had concentrated liquid morphine before, but I'm sure it's probably good. And it'll probably take me out of myself real quick. I mean, for God's sakes, they're spoon feeding it to my grandma. You know what I mean? So what happens if I take 3-4 times that much? So like I said, the conversation with my grandma ended. I got right up. I figured out a way to get some of this stuff with me. And I do that. And as I'm doing it, I look down and my grandma's watching me do all this. Like I'm dumping this into like a Ziploc bag and doing all this crazy stuff. And she's looking at me the whole time I'm doing it. And I zip the bag up, put it back on the shelf, and I'm walking out the door. I don't even say nothing to her. And I glance down and she's watching me walk out of the room. And I got that call that night or the next day saying that my grandma passed away that night. The last thing my grandma ever seen me do was steal from her, steal medication and steal, you know. And she watched me do this entire thing. And I felt absolutely no remorse about it at the time. My first thinking was, well, she doesn't need that anymore then. So I didn't really take it from her. And that goes back to me rationalizing and justifying every single thing I do that's horrible. I look at it like, well, there's a way around it. It's really not that big a deal. So moving on to 2008, I get arrested a couple times for the normal alcoholic stuff. I start going to court a bunch down in Baltimore, spending the night in central bookings all night, sleeping on a dirty, pissy floor. And I end up postponing all these court dates, so they end up in the same week. And this was like October of 08. And somehow, man, I get off of all these charges. I get like a nil pros, which is like they can't prosecute me until unless they get further evidence, which there was no evidence to get. So towards these last 3 months of 08, 3 or 4 months, I'm like, I'm so miserable. My parents, like I was living on the street. My parents let me come into their house because I told them I was going to rehab. And in wintertime, rehabs fill up real quick. Like, that's just the nature of the beast, man. When it's warm outside, they empty out because people can sleep outside. When it's cold, they need somewhere to go. And, so that my mom let me stay at her house, which was amazing. I'm surprised she did. And every day I'm driving my car, you know, going to get another 40 or a bottle of something, you know what I mean, from money that I stole from somewhere. And just wanting to crash my car into a tree. Looking at every tree like, nah, that one's not going to work, or I might not die from that one, or that'll be too messy, and then I'll have to clean up everything. Like, that, these are every single tree I pass is like that. And it's such a horrible way to live, and I hate feeling like that. And even thinking about it turns my stomach, because I felt like that on a daily basis for so many years. So I started calling this rehab in York. And I called them every day for a while, and they didn't have any beds, and they said, keep calling back. And every day turned into every other day, and every other day turned into once a week. And finally, it was December, the end of December, and they called and said they had a bed. But for some reason, I had other things to do right away. So that bed got filled real quick. And then they called me back again on January 16th, and my little brother lived at my parents' house, and he was going away for basic training that day. Or he went through basic training and he was going to South Korea. And he was packing to leave. And they called me. And I was so, like, I had my bag packed for rehab for like 2 months. Packed, ready to go, sitting next to my bed. They called and said, we can get you in today. But they probably won't be able to pick you up till like 6 at night. And this was like 9 in the morning. And I said, well, if I get a ride right now, can I come now? And they said, yeah, if you can get a ride. And I was like, I was on that, I don't know, I'm sure people in here understand what I'm talking about. I was on that point where I knew if I didn't go in there right then and there, if I didn't find a way there, that I would probably leave and steal something and do something else and whatever. And I probably would not have made it there that day. And we were talking the way up, like if I would have somehow scored $100 that day, I probably wouldn't have made the rehab that day. And I might have died that day. But I knew that I needed to run on this, whatever was forcing me to you know, catch this ride and do all these things. And I went into my brother's room as he's packing to leave. And I said, hey, man, can you take me up to York real quick? And I had never been to York before in my life. And he said, yeah. You know, my little brother's the only person in my entire life ever that's never judged me for anything I've ever done. You know, that's why he's also in my wedding party. You know what I mean? And you know, I love him. You know what I mean? He's always been there for me. So he said, absolutely. And he took me right up there to rehab. And I remember standing out there and, like, walking up to the doors. I felt such this relief. I don't know. Like, it was just like I took this book bag of bricks just off and left them. Like, I just felt, like, released. I felt like it's over. Finally, God, it's over. Thank God. And I go in there. And as I go in, I'm drunk. You know what I mean? Because I got the last time, you got to go in there. You can't go in there sober. Who goes into rehab sober? Oh, my God. I don't know anybody that did. But as I'm in there, you know, they're taking all my information, all that, and I go back and I'm in detox for a couple of days, and I'm not sleeping. You know what I mean? I'm shaking. I'm sick. I'm hot. I'm cold. I feel horrible. But I need to be held down. Like, I can't do this stuff on my couch. I've tried it. Like, all the worst stuff that I had on my four step, happened when I tried to do this on my own. Like, when I tried to sit on my couch and go 5 days, you know, and that the end of that fifth day, when I felt a little bit better and I wanted to reward myself and I had no money, you know, these are the things that I would never tell anybody things like this. You know what I mean? Like, there's no way. But if I keep all that stuff inside, like, I'm never going to get better, man. So I'm there for like 4 or 5 days. I'm up at like 4 or 3 in the morning, whatever it was. I wasn't sleeping. And they said, oh, you're leaving today. And like this dread dropped over me, like, oh my God. Like, I said, this can't be. Like, I thought you go to rehab. When you go to rehab, I thought it was like detox and rehab. Like, I thought it was like combo pack. You know what I mean? Like, you're going and you're staying for 28 days. I thought that's what it was. But they seem to think different, you know. I was there for like 4 or 5 days. And they said that I had to leave. And the next morning, in the morning meeting, I'm telling people, like, if you let me leave this rehab, I'm going to die. Like, I'm going to leave here and I'm going to do what I do. Like, I guarantee you, I have no doubt in my mind this is going to happen. They tried whatever they could. They tried to give me scholarships. They tried to give me everything to stay in that rehab. Because they knew, they could tell the look in my face. They knew that if you let me out of this place, I'm taking my will back right away. It's coming with me as I leave this rehab. And as soon as that door shuts, I don't know where I'm going. I don't know what's happening. But I guarantee I'm going to be drunk ASAP. Like, because I can't deal with life on life's terms when I have zero solution in my life. I can't do it. So it didn't work out. They made me leave. My dad came and picked me up. The lady at the thing said, you have to sit in this welfare office all day and try to get medical assistance. And I don't know if anyone's sat in a welfare office in the city all day long. It's not fun at all. It's horrible, actually. And I sat there all day, and they still didn't do it. So they said, come back tomorrow. And I sat there all day the next day. And I'd like to say, like, no matter how serious I was about getting sober, no matter how long I was sitting in that welfare office, no matter how horrible it was, I'm still hot, I'm still cold, I'm still sick, I want to throw up. That night, it was January 22nd. That night, when my parents fell asleep, I'm sitting there, and I have no defense over the first drink. I have no defense whatsoever. This thing just all of a sudden, I look at it like a switch in my head, it just flipped. And it was like, they're sleeping. You know, they're probably not locking their door because they know that I'm going back to rehab tomorrow. So I know where the bank card's at. I know what his PIN number is. So I do that sneaky army crawl, alcoholic crawl into the bedroom, steal the bank card. And I leave that night, and then I go out and I get destroyed. And I actually tell one of my friends that's with me, I say, look, man, don't call an ambulance unless my heart stops, unless I stop breathing. Like, that's the only way. Don't call ambulance anything else before that. I was like, just keep an eye on me. I don't remember getting home that night. I don't remember doing any of that stuff. like I said, no matter how willing I was to do this, they let me out of there. And it wasn't to prove to anybody that I was serious. It was the fact that I needed to shut my head up, and I had no solution. I cannot stop drinking. If you leave me to myself and to my own devices, I'm going to get drunk, period. Like, I don't know what it is, and that's just the way I am. Like, I've come to understand more being in AA and doing 12 steps and trying to understand it by myself. I've come to learn more about that. I have a disease of alcoholism, man, and if I don't have no solution, like, I'm not going to get better. So fast forward, they let me back into rehab, and that was January 23rd, and that's my sobriety date. I did the 28 days, and they said, where are you going from here? I said, send me wherever you think I should go, because I've been told all through rehab, they said, take directions, take suggestions, listen, say yes to what they tell you to do. I said, all right. And they said, in York, we got tons of recovery houses. I don't know if you know about York, but there are a ton of recovery houses. They said, you know, the recovery house. I said, well, if you send me to one, send me to the strictest one you got, because if no one's holding me down and you give me some rope to hang myself with, I will absolutely do that. And so they did. They sent me to the strictest recovery house in York. and it was easy, man. Like, I was willing, you know. Like, if you don't send me somewhere where they're going to make me go to a meeting the first day, I probably won't, because I'm lazy. But they made me do these things. They made me get a sponsor, all this stuff. And through stumbling for the first 9 months between sponsors and this, I had like 6 sponsors my first year. Because I get to the third step and I don't want to turn my will over. Then I get to the fourth step and I don't want to write nothing because I'm lazy and I don't like writing things. And I don't want to tell you about myself. I don't want you to think, you know, less of me than I think you already do, you know, which is crazy. But finally, I do get a sponsor. And I get that thing called untreated alcoholism. I don't know if anyone's ever known what that is or encountered that before, but I think it's worse than drinking. Because I got nothing to shut my head up. And that untreated alcoholism was the first time in my life I ever wanted to seriously hurt people. Like, people in meetings that got here after me that were smiling and happy, and I was there for 9 months, and they just got here 3 months ago, and they're smiling, happy, having a good life, having people give them rides to meetings. And I'm some miserable guy sitting with a bunch of other miserable guys in my recovery house that aren't doing anything. And I seriously want to hurt people. And I've never felt like that. I've never been a violent person. You know what I mean? But I felt violent, you know, and I knew that was these guys were talking about, that untreated alcoholism. If I don't got nothing, if I don't have no solution, it's going to keep getting worse until a drink is like the best solution for me. So I do get a sponsor, and I remember asking him, I was at this gratitude meeting, asked him to sponsor me, and he, you know, I don't know what I was thinking he was going to say, but he said, he just asked me if I had a book, and he told me to read the doctor's opinion, and he told me to, like, underline things that applied to me personally. He told me to circle words or phrases that I didn't understand, and I read the forewords, because I believe that's important as well. And I got busy. Anything he asked me to do, I did it. He said, you know, when I got the third step, which the third step is probably one of my favorite things, without it, every day, without turning my will over, I said the third step prayer. It's on page 63, if you don't know. Third step prayer is one of my favorite things in the world, man. It made so much sense to me the first time I read it. And I say that prayer twice a day, in the morning and at night, when I get on my knees. And that third step, man, I love it. I love it so much. And he gave me a four step, and he laid it out for me right out of the book. And he said, you got 2 weeks to do this. And he told me to call him every day, and I still was calling him every day, and I didn't, you know, 2 weeks. And I was working like 50 hours a week then. I was still going to meetings every single day, and I got it done in 2 weeks. Because I have a lot of guys that make excuses for why they can't get it done in 2 weeks. I did, and I had a lot. You know, my sponsor made me write a harms list with my four step, which was like 7 pages front and back and just garbage that I need to get off my chest. That's the way he wanted me to do it, and I did it like that. I went over it with him, and things, I felt like I was, like, moving. You know, I felt like I was in AA. I felt like I was part of it. I felt like I was doing some things. And I continue to go through the steps, man. I'm making amends to this day. I'm still making amends. Now, let me just back up just a hair. In that hole between the 9 months and 12-month period, I moved out of recovery house, moved to a sober house. And in the sober house, there was 5 other guys that moved in there with me. And they were all my friends that I've met since I got to York. They were all good friends of mine. Some of them still are. And it's unfortunate that the 2 that did come back just went out recently. Again, for almost getting 2 years, he's one of my best friends, and it sucks, and there's nothing I can do about it, except for be there when he wants me to be there. But I slowly watched each one of these guys, one at a time, you know, get drunk and get high and get kicked out of this house. And I lived there for 2 months by myself in a sober house, which was good because I didn't have to really clean up much. You know what I mean? Like, G.I. was like doing my dish from last night, you know. But I liked it, though, you know what I mean? Then the owner moved in, and then I met a girl in AA, and she moved in. Of course, that's how we do. You know what I mean? That's how we do, unfortunately. But, and she got, you know, she got pregnant, and and I don't know if anyone's ever had the experience of dealing with a pregnant girl in early sobriety. And she had relapsed and came back, and she was going through the steps, and she was, you know, doing this thing. But regardless of how many steps you do, like, no offense, but when girls are pregnant, I don't care if you're alcoholic or not, it's tough. I gotta bite my tongue a lot, you know what I mean? Because like, it's just like, I don't know, chemical imbalance, I don't know what it is, hormones or whatever, but it was tough, you know what I mean? And I stayed sober for that. And she stayed sober, and she got a good sponsor and started working steps, started helping people and getting busy, man. Like, and that was awesome to see, because I see, you know, you get to see people's lives change, you get to see people smiling and helping people and sticking their hand out without wanting anything in return. And that was important. Like, I like that. Like, I want to be a good person. I want to help whoever I can. I don't want to be a scumbag. I don't. I never did want to be one. But I felt like I had no choice. Like, when they say, like, people go out and say, well, he had a choice. He made that choice. No, if you know anything about alcoholism, like, if you ain't doing nothing, you lose that choice. Like, if you ain't doing nothing, if you ain't helping nobody, if you ain't working those steps and taking a look at yourself and doing the right thing, like, you lose that choice. Like, alcoholism takes over, man, and you have no choice, and it's too late. And it's like, you see people going down a bad road, and you want to just kick them in the ass, and but it's not up to me, you know? So, you know, she got pregnant, and she started working some steps again, and really getting busy, man. And I got busy, too, and we stayed out of each other's sobriety, you know? One thing my sponsor told me is, like, her sobriety is none of your business. You know, yeah, she's pregnant with your kid and all that, but it's none of your business. I told her one time to write a gratitude list, and she was, like, 7 months pregnant. And, Needless to say, I've never ever done that again. Oh my God. And I survived that, you know what I mean? And that's because of AA, you know what I mean? Because and I'm not ever gonna say that to her again, you know what I mean? Anything like that. And we don't do that back and forth. You know what I mean? We might discuss certain things as far as AA go, like, you know, whatever it is, we might discuss it. Like, what would you do in this situation? Or what would you tell one of your guys if this happened? You know what I mean? But we don't discuss names. We know about the traditions. We know about the steps. We don't. It's not like that. You know what I mean? It's just someone else. It's like another person in my support group. And we stay out of each other's sobriety. You know what I mean? People got to bust their heads sometimes. You know? If I hadn't made the mistakes I made in sobriety, I don't think, you know, I would be where I'm at today. That's just how it is. Like, I got to make my own mistakes. I can't learn from other people's mistakes. Like, people say, that's the best way to do it, learn from other. Yeah, that doesn't work for me. You know, someone tells me, don't do this because this will happen. I'm like, let's try that out. I don't know about that. I don't believe you. And then I bust my head and then I learn. You know, like, I put my hand on the stove a lot when I was a kid, like literally, seriously, and I got burned a lot, and because I don't know what it is, I just, maybe it'll be different this time, and it never is. So we had a daughter, you know what I mean? Her birthday is 8/9/10, And I'm a dad today, you know what I mean? Like, I always wanted to be a dad. It was like the one thing I always wanted to be. And I want, like, and not that I have a kid, it's that I'm a father, and I take the responsibilities and stuff as a father, and I can't get enough of my daughter, man. She's the coolest thing ever, and I love her so much. And she grew up in AA so far. I mean, she's going to be 2 in August, and she, ever since she was an infant, like, she was 2 weeks old when we brought her to her first meeting. And we brought her to meeting after meeting. All the meetings we went to, we brought her with us. Now, we can only bring her to meetings to have child care. Because, I don't know if you know, a little 21, 22-month-old kid running around, she's stealing people's purses and beating on stuff and yelling. It's not, you know what I mean? It's not, it won't work. But luckily, we have a lot of meetings with child care in York. I made another, I actually got 2 home groups. I made one of this other one, White Rose, because they have child care, and it's on Fridays, and it's like a block and a half from my house. Because I was told to be of service, you know. So since I went through the steps, I'm on my 3rd sponsor going through the steps. I'm going through the steps with another guy, you know what I mean, after I did it 2 times with 2 other guys. And that's not because I'm copping out or anything like that. Like, I believe, like, I heard a guy come and speak one time, and this clicked with me. He said, he's like, your sobriety is contingent upon your spiritual maintenance. And he said, I don't believe in that at all. He's like, maintenance is just, you know, keeping it running. He's like, I need spiritual growth, you know. And that made so much sense to me. Like, that clicked in my head. And I was like, I need to learn more. I need to get involved. I need to see what else is out there. And, you know, when the sponsor is too busy, this or that, I went up and I thanked him for everything he's done for me. And he's still part of my support group. And he took me through the steps and he helped me a lot. He saved my life. Because God talked through him. Like, God's a big part of my life, and I pray to him every single day. But I moved on, and I'm growing, and then I had another sponsor, the next guy, you know, you kind of outgrow people sometimes. Like, if, you know, he made the comment, he's like, you're working a better program than I am, you know what I mean? And I want someone to be like a spiritual guide and help me when I come with situations, especially with relationships, like, and not, I was told that the sponsor is there to take you through the steps, and that's it. But the sponsor I got now, he's about giving you any kind of experience and help that he possibly can and be of maximum service to God's kids. You know what I mean? I'm one of God's kids, so I get to reap the benefits because he's a smart man. He's been around for a long time, and he helps me a lot. So I have no problem with stuff like that. You know what I mean? Moving on, trying to grow, things like that. And when people ask me to do things, like especially like drive out here, like I have no problem doing it. I was told to say yes. You know what I mean? I was told to, when I get here, like get a home group, get a service commitment, and get involved, meet people. You know, when people ask you to do things for AA, like we got a little trick thing we do kind of in New York. I don't even probably do it out here too. And it's like, hey, you want to be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous? And right then and there, they know, like, all right, man, what do you want me to do? Just tell me what you want me to do. Because you can't say no to that. If you're working pro, you can't say no to that. And I got a couple people with that. And I've got with that as well. But it's just, like, my life is great today. I love AA. Like, AA is the best thing that's ever happened to me. Because if not for all this other stuff that, you know, being able to learn about turning my will over and making amends and looking at the kind of person I am and try to pay things back that I owe that's, because it's not my money, you know what I mean? And I work hard, and I have a family, and I don't have no money, you know what I mean? But I still make my amends payments, and I still make all my payments, and it's tough sometimes, you know what I mean? But I trust in God. I know, like, I don't, like, if I put my bills out and list them all down, and the money that's coming in, it doesn't work out. But somehow my bills get paid, and I don't know how that is, and I wish I could explain it to you, but like, my child care payment is almost as much as my rent is. And it's crazy, man, but it works out, you know, because we're both doing the right thing, you know what I mean? And and it's just, it makes sense to just keep doing the right thing. And every time, like, I have a thing when, like, with spiritual consequences, like, if I lie or cheat or steal today about something, like, and then later on I don't know, something happens, I lose money, or I trip and bust my face on something, or like, that's the way I look at things, man. I look at, I don't even call it karma, you can call it whatever, I call it spiritual consequences. Because if I don't do the right thing to the next person, to one of God's kids, then it's going to come back on me. And it always has so far since I've been sober, since I've been paying attention. You know what I mean? Because a long time I wasn't paying attention. I thought that I deserved everything that happened to me. But God knows that if I got what I deserved, I would not be standing here right now. I would not have the life that I have today. You know, I would not have a beautiful daughter that's healthy. That when I was leaving to come out here, you know what I mean? She wanted me to come play in her little kitchen with her. She was like, Daddy. And it was like the hardest thing to do is leave now. You know what I mean? But I can imagine myself, like if I was out there, I could imagine that not, you know, not being as important as it is today. Like, I don't got to steal my daughter's presents before Christmas. You know what I mean? I hear people having to do that, and I could see myself doing stuff like that. Because I'm capable of the most horrific things I could imagine is what I'm capable of. Because if you put in a position that I need without a solution and I need to do something to get me out of myself, I'm going to do whatever it takes. And that's part of my amends process today, is like making amends for some of the things that I've done that I wish I never did, but it's too late. Like, I just want to, just real quick, I want to talk about another person, like, in my life. My uncle, who was one of that guy I was talking about that helped raise me, he lived above me. I think about him every day. He's the only person that's passed away that I really, like, even though I was out there, I, like, cried so long and so hard about it for so long. Like, it upset me. It was like losing my dad. And I had a similar situation that I had with my grandma. The last time I seen him, I did some things to him that I shouldn't have done. And that was one of the main things that I needed to do when I wrote my A-step. And I talked about it. I was like, what do I do about this? You know what I mean? Like, I can't see him. Like, I really honestly believe he's looking down on me. He sees me and he sees my daughter and he sees my fiance and he sees, you know, what I'm doing and how I'm living today. And I know he's, like, just smiling at me. You know what I mean? Trying to make it some joke or something, you know? And I miss him, you know what I mean? And I was told that I write something out that's saying, like I'm talking to him. Like, I was sitting down talking to him, writing amends to him like I was talking to him. And sit at his grave and read it. You know, if that's what it takes, that's what it takes. That was one of the most important things to me. Like, I'm slowly starting. It's been like 3.5 years, and I've been working on this the whole time. Like, I'm slowly starting to come to grips with that situation alone with my uncle. Because, like, he meant so much to me, you know what I mean? And I wish I could take it back, but then again, I look back and I don't regret anything that's ever happened in my life, anything I've ever done. Because whatever I've done, I needed to do to get to where I am today, and I'm happy with my life today. I sleep at night and I can smile and I have fun and I love my family and I go home and I joke and I have friends today that call me, you know, not because they want something from me, just because they want to know what's going on, you know what I mean? And people ask me for advice today, which I think is crazy, but I can just give, you know, my experience. Like, I get to give other guys that are about to be fathers, I get to give them experience on being a dad and sobriety. And that's amazing. You know what I mean? Like, I believe that's one of the gifts God gave me, was the experience of being a dad in sobriety to help somebody else with. And, like, in anything, my sponsor told me, anything that I've done on my 4-step that I was ashamed of or that was horrible or this or that, someone else has gone through it. Someone else can probably relate to you, and you can probably help them with that and tell them how you got over it and how you dealt with it and how you moved through it. And I believe that, man. When guys come to me and they tell me things that they didn't want to ever tell anybody else, all I tell them is, like, there's some other guy out there that it's happened to, and you can help him with that. You know what I mean? And that's why that happened. Maybe you can be of service to 5 other guys that happened to. And that's what it's about, man. Sharing your experience with other people and trying to help them, trying to get through them, like helping God's kids. Like, we're talking about my favorite 2 months of the year for meetings is March and December, because it's on the 3rd step and it's on the 12th step. You know, turning my will over and service work. My life didn't start changing and getting better until I started helping people. And I honestly believe that. Like, you can go through the steps. I don't care, you go through the steps 20 times. If you ain't doing a 12-step, if you ain't helping nobody, if you ain't, you know, if you ain't going out there and sharing this message with people, and if you ain't, you know, trying to, I don't necessarily sponsor people, but just be of service to people in general. And like, I hate dressing up. I just want to say that. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous and what it's given to me, like, when he texted me and said it's a shirt and tie thing, because some means in New York we don't have shirt and tie. I don't have a tie. I borrowed it. I'm wearing sneakers. The shirt, the tie doesn't really match the shirt. But that's all right, though. You know what I mean? Because I will do it because Alcoholics Anonymous has given me so much. And I would not be standing here. I would not be living. I would not be a dad. I would not be getting ready to get married to someone, a beautiful girl that, and you know, I never thought I'd get married because who the hell would want to marry a scumbag like me? And today, I don't feel like that. I don't feel like I'm a scumbag. You know what I mean? I put my head on the pillow and I know I'm a good person. Someone I always wanted to be a good person, and today I honestly believe that I am. And if I stop doing these things that I was taught from day one in AA, which is helping people, trust in God, clean house, and help others. And that's part of the things we're doing in York. And that's what I learned in York, and I stick with that. You know, trusting in God on a daily basis. I turn to page 86 and I get on my knees and I read the first half of 86 in the morning and the second half at night, and I stay my third step, and I thank God for keeping me sober. And these are the things that if I don't keep doing this, like I was doing my 11th step, laying in bed, picturing the page in my head and reading it out, laying in bed. And then I come to find out that if I, you know, the half measures avail us nothing. You know, people throw that around a lot. But until you actually think about it, like, yeah, that's me half-stepping. Like, I'm laying in bed doing my 11th step. I need to get on my knees and be thankful and grateful. Like, what's me taking 2 minutes out of my day to get down on my knees and try to do my meditation the best of my ability? Everybody meditates different, but the way I do it works for me. So like I said, my home group is The Way Out in York. If you're ever in York, it's Thursdays and Saturdays at 8 p.m., And my other one's White Rose, and that's on 8 p.m. on Fridays. And Fridays and Saturdays, speaker meeting. Thursdays is a discussion meeting. Thank you for letting me share.